This is the ARC Energy Ideas Podcast with Peter Terzakian and Jackie Forrest, exploring trends that influence the energy business.
Welcome, I'm Peter Terzakian. It is October 19th, 2018.
And I'm Jackie Forrest.
Welcome to ARC Energy Ideas Podcast. Topics for today, Jackie, what are we talking about?
Well, we're going to talk about lots going on in the global oil markets, and we'll talk about some of the recent news lines around economic headwinds and this Jamal Khashoggi situation.
Oh yeah, we got to talk about that. And I'm also interested in the narrative from the oil and gas supermajors. They've got this new initiative, the Oil and Gas Climate Initiative, that we want to talk about.
Right, 13 oil and gas majors coming together with the goal of decarbonizing oil and gas.
Yeah.
And then we're going to talk about some interesting new technologies that they are investing in as part of that initiative. So maybe we'll get going with topic one, oil market situation. So, well, first of all, let's talk about the potential for economic headwinds. Now, the oil markets, first of all, are looking very tight. We've had a lot of supply losses from Iran and Venezuela. And although increasing production from Russia and Saudi has helped offset that, the market is very tight, very low spare capacity right now. In fact, about 2% based on where Saudi is producing right now is estimated. But because of this tight market, we've seen a real rally in the Brent price, you know, up near $80 per barrel versus $65 earlier this year. And some people say we're one major outage away from $100 oil.
You think all it would take is just one more outage in or something in Nigeria or some other part of the world that is a major oil producer, and that would be enough to spike it up?
Well, the reality is we just don't know how much spare capacity, you know, can come on quickly. Saudi Arabia says they have 1.3 million barrels a day still, but we don't know how fast that could respond.
Right.
And that's really all we have. And, you know, countries like Libya have shown that they can lose 600,000 barrels a day of production very quickly.
You know, that spare capacity is an interesting number if you really think about it. You just said, like, Saudi Arabia is basically the only country in the world that has 1.3 million barrels a day on 100 million of total demand. You know, so that's basically 1.3% reserve margin if you're using electrical power terms, or utilization of 98%. You know, I mean, it's just ridiculous how thin this vital supply chain to the world is.
It really is. And that's why we are getting sort of concerns around economic headwinds, but we have to keep in our minds just how tight the market is and how little spare capacity we have.
Right. But
let's talk about the news. There's been kind of a series of news items that have resulted in prices weakening a little bit over the last week or so. First of all, this talk of the trade war, this has been going on for a while, but now finally we're starting to see economic outlooks revised down. We had the IEA and IMF and OECD all reduce the outlook for economic growth.
So this is all due to Donald Trump and his administration's policy of imposing tariffs predominantly on China.
That's right.
Right.
So, you know, today about half of all Chinese goods into the U.S. are tariffed, and actually nearly almost all U.S. goods into China are tariffed. And when people look at the impact of that, they're basically saying instead of global economic growth being like 3.9% in 2019, maybe it's going to be 0.4% less. So it's still not a, you know, it's still a fairly small impact on the global number, but it's starting to be showing up in the outlooks and getting people more concerned. And you know, that resulted in last week a very closely watched report about the oil market. The IEA every month comes out with this oil market report, had similar warnings and basically started to reduce their outlook for oil demand. Now, it's small right now. They basically reduced it by 0.1 million barrels a day. So next year, they're still expecting about 1.4 million barrels a day of demand, which is still a very high number.
Oh, yeah. I mean, anything over a million barrels a day is just considered a lot. That means that if this year we're at 100 million barrels per day of consumption, next year we're going to 101.3 instead of 101.4.
Right. Yes. So it's still really minor, but I think it's just, you know, the market sees, oh, there's going to be maybe some oil demand issues. You know, they talked about a number of factors. First of all, the weaker economic outlook, which I already talked about, but also the impact of higher oil prices now on the economy that could slow the use of oil, and also some weaker Chinese data. You know, this grabbed the headlines a bit last week as well. You know, the timing was not great because we also had the stock market down last week. So if you look at our ARC energy charts that we post each week, you can see that the S&P 500 fell about 6% last week, and the Shanghai index is down too.
Yeah, so the market's starting to respond to this, but let's explore the dynamic that's occurring in the International Energy Agency report. So basically what they are acknowledging is the coupling between the global economy and energy demand, and as a subset of that, oil demand. In other words, every change in economic activity, as measured by GDP, has an impact on how much energy people use. And as I said, as a subset of that, how much oil they use. So it's interesting because in industrialized economies, such as North America, European Union, Japan, Korea, Australia, New Zealand, and so on, otherwise known as the OECD, right, which are mature economies, a 1% change in GDP doesn't really actually move the needle that much. And why is that? It's because these economies have already industrialized. They're quite mature. In fact, I think the number is about a 1% change, for example, in U.S. GDP would result probably only like a 50,000 barrels per day change in global oil consumption. It's not much. Where you have to look is in the non-OECD, right? The countries that are in that industrialization phase, certainly dominated by China. There's India, there's Vietnam, there's Thailand, there's Indonesia, even the Middle East. And what you find is that countries that are in their industrialization phase are much more coupled to energy consumption and GDP.
Right. Yeah, it makes a lot of sense, right? Yeah. Like the developed countries, a lot of their economic growth is related to people sitting in offices maybe and services.
Yeah, services.
Where these developing countries, a lot of their economic growth is tied to manufacturing and building and construction that take a lot more energy.
Right. And if you look at the dynamic that's happened over the course of the last 25 years, is that there's been a mass outsourcing of manufacturing, in other words, the loss of manufacturing jobs, which is what the Trump administration is concerned about, over to Asia and places like that where there's low labor costs. And that migration of manufacturing to the industrializing economies means that they are far more coupled to using, say, more or less oil, depending upon what their economic growth is. So that's where we have to watch. But now what we're seeing with that IEA report, the IMF report, and indeed the stock market, the S&P fell 6% last week, but the Chinese stock indicators are down way more.
Right. They're actually down about 20% since early this year. So they've been hit much harder than the U.S. so far.
Right. Because it's much more sensitive. And I think this is what actually the Americans are sort of realizing as they put these tariffs on it, is that it's actually helping to slow down the Chinese economy, which in a geopolitical sense is probably what they probably want as well. So if you try and put it all together and say the economy is going to slow down, in fact, we haven't had a recession in 10 years, not really since the financial crisis, that the reflection of the IEA and the IMF is an understanding that a slowdown in economy, both in industrializing and non-industrializing world, means that we're going to see lower oil demand. But it's not really that much because on a base of 100 million barrels per day, that's just a gigantic it's an unfathomable amount of consumption.
And at this level of economic growth, even though it's less than before, we still have a lot of oil growth. We're not talking about contraction by anything, by any means.
Yeah.
Right?
Contraction is when the economy actually shrinks. The last time we saw that was in the financial crisis, and the time before that was, I think, like World War II. We're not talking contraction here. We're talking about a slowdown in economic growth, which means a slowdown in energy consumption growth.
Right.
Growth. So, and this is really key, is that, you know, I come back to, let's say we're going from 100 to 101.3, not 101.4.
Okay. But this thing that's worrying people is, you know, I got all this news last week, then I open up my new version of The Economist.
Yeah.
And what it says is the next recession, how bad will it be? So some people are saying that what's been factored in already isn't the full story.
Right.
And they have this picture, really graphical picture of this, you know, a line going straight up. A guy hanging off it at the top, and it comes straight down again.
It's like falling off a cliff. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, The Economist has on occasion been known for its hyperbole in terms of situations. But, you know, we can't dismiss, again, the reality that we haven't really seen a global contraction. That means like every single region of the world's economy actually starting to recede in its economic growth. The last time we saw that was in the financial crisis. And so that will have an impact. And we know that small changes in growth estimates amplify into changes in oil price, right?
Right, right. And to your point, by the way, when you read the articles, they are predicting this isn't going to be like the financial crisis, maybe like the 2001 recession.
Right. And what did that do in terms of?
Back then, oil demand growth slowed from 1.5 million barrels a day to 800,000. So kind of cut in half.
Now that is material, right? If you have a really severe global recession, like you're going to see a significant amount of demand growth. Again, emphasize on the growth cutback. You know,
yeah, we still had growth.
Right. We're still going well over 100 million barrels per day. It's just a matter of degree.
Right. And actually, I would argue, based on what you just told me, the economy has changed a lot since 2001.
Yeah.
We're less levered to energy for GDP growth. And so probably we'd probably see still over a million barrels. And considering how tight the market is right now, I think you could still have a relatively tight market with a million barrels a day of oil demand growth next year.
Yeah. Okay. So the conclusion is we got to watch it. But growing at a million barrels per day, the geopolitical overlays mean that, you know, we're not going back to the $30 world, but you could potentially see a bit of easing in the price.
Right.
Right. But there's a global, all this geopolitical intrigue happening now too.
Right. Talking about geopolitical risk. So you would have to be living under a rock to not have heard that the Saudis are under pressure with this Jamal Khashoggi situation. Basically, he was a Washington Post columnist critical of Saudi Arabia that went into this embassy in Turkey and didn't come back out.
Yeah,
a lot of questions about what happened to him, and it's looking like he did die there, but there's, you know, still putting the full story together. Now, when it comes to oil and geopolitics, the concerning bit is the response last week by Saudi Arabia after Trump threatened maybe some severe punishment if he, in fact, was killed. They basically said, and this came from the official Saudi press agency, if there are any threats and economic sanctions, Saudi will respond with a greater action. And this was followed up by someone who headed up the public news channel saying that the U.S. would stab its own economy to death if they were to put a sanction against Saudi Arabia, and oil prices would soar to $200 a barrel or maybe even double that figure.
Yeah, well, I think it's a new world today. I mean, I'm not trying to diminish the severity and the grimness of the situation. So notwithstanding all the intrigue about what exactly happened, stepping back and look at the geopolitics of this. I mean, the last time we had Saudi Arabia and that region exert influence over price as a sort of retaliatory measure was in 1973 with the Arab oil embargo and so on. And back then, they did have a lot of levers to pull because the United States and much of the rest of the world was resolutely addicted to Saudi oil. Today, there's no question. I mean, what do they supply? 10, 11 million barrels per day
they're,
to the world?
Yeah, they're producing near 11 million barrels
a day. About 11%.
At a record high level, actually.
At a record high level. But the important thing, and I think why the U.S. administration is feeling a little more robust in these threats, is that the United States has had the tight oil revolution in the Permian, the Eagle Ford, the Bakken, et cetera. And even Canada as a continental unit provides much of the heavy oils. So as a continental unit, we are now geopolitically immune, at least from the threat of any supply shortages like we had in 1973.
Right. Like you can still, I see the pictures, right, of all the long lineups at the gas pumps. You know, when you start to hear this talk this weekend, it kind of gives you that visual. But you're right. Although there are some imports of Saudi crude, it's not what it used to be, and it could be replaced. And North America has a lot more oil independence than it did.
They do. So it's going to be interesting to watch. And I think the countries that need to be more worried about it are those that are dependent upon oil from the Middle East, particularly Saudi Arabia, because a lot of these supply chains globally over the last half dozen years have shifted, you know, the tanker trade routes, et cetera, because of the shale revolution in the United States and even here in Canada. We are flush with oil relative to where we were 10 years ago.
Right. But from a supply situation, it's not looking like a threat. But from a price situation, it does matter.
Oh, sure.
You know, if they cut supplies, we will see higher prices everywhere, including in North America.
Yeah.
Now, I think it's worth me adding that the Saudis did backpedal, saying later that this person was not the official opinion of the kingdom. And also the energy minister, Khalid al-Fahil, also assured some speakers at a conference that Saudi would remain a responsible, stable supplier of oil. But the facts are, this official press agency had put out this threat. So there was definitely something coming from the top trying to put this message out.
Yeah.
And I think this really means there's more geopolitical risk going forward than there would have been before this incident. And we got a very tight market. So these sorts of things, worries about supply do really matter.
It does matter. I personally don't think it's going to come to that. I don't see the $200 barrel of situation or anything like that. I think they would be very foolish to do so, because when you get to those sorts of levels, again, it just triggers all sorts of chaos and ultimately works against the interests of all producers, including the Saudis. But anyway, we shall watch it carefully, and we shall watch the response of the various countries and also the industry. And we've got some big changes on the industry, too, in terms of the narrative.
Right. So we talked quite a bit last week about the need to reduce GHG emissions and this climate change report that came out saying that we need to do more. And so we wanted to highlight an initiative from oil and gas majors on climate change called the Oil and Gas Climate Initiative. And basically, we've got 13 major producers coming together. They're doing many things, including voluntary targets for their greenhouse gas emission reductions. But they're also investing in new businesses and have put together a $1 billion investment fund targeting technologies that would reduce greenhouse gas emissions, not only from the upstream oil and gas, but they're also looking kind of downstream and how can we decarbonize the oil and gas. Yeah. They're saying that they believe, and I agree with them, that oil and gas is going to be here for some time. And so the responsible thing to do is try to make oil and gas as low carbon as we can, reduce its carbon intensity, and contribute to solving the pressing issue of climate change.
Yeah, I mean, I'm actually really heartened by this. It's something that I know you and I, Jackie, have been talking about for a long time, that the oil and gas industry really needs to be part of the solution rather than be always in defensive mode about the subject of climate change and carbon emissions and so on. So an acknowledgement by 13 of the big super majors that this is an issue, they're going to start spending money on it, is, I think, really quite welcome. Interestingly, it sort of begs the question of how incumbents in an industry, entrenched incumbents in an industry like the oil and gas industry, can sort of shift gears and start migrating to a new paradigm of energy delivery, right? And I like to think of it in terms of other industries or other big companies that have shifted over time. I mean, I can think of two, like General Electric is one that's started out in Thomas Edison's day. He was effectively one of the founders, and over the years has evolved and actually is evolving again with their new CEO, presumably. But they've been able to adapt. IBM,
right.
Other countries.
They had a 100-year anniversary, IBM. Companies are 100 years old?
Yeah, and you know, they made some pretty tough decisions back in the 90s in terms of the businesses they were going to be in and shifting strategy and pivoting, you know, quite dramatically in terms of the philosophy of the business. So it can be done. I think that these 13 companies are recognizing that, and that amongst other things, I think they're going to start sharing ideas and technologies, aren't they?
Well, and that's really important. So I totally agree with you. This is, and by the way, this is just one piece of the strategy you're seeing. You know, some of these big producers like Shell and BP have come out investing in other types of energy. So this is one component of their strategy. But, you know, I think the fact that they're willing to share technology is very interesting and unique. If you look at the history of the oil and gas industry, there haven't been very many examples. Companies looked at technology as their differentiators, their competitive advantage, and didn't want to share ideas. You only actually saw a couple of examples. And actually, I would say Canada blazed the trail here.
Yep.
We had the Alberta Oil Sands Technology and Research Authority, which is one of the first examples of coming together to share technology, basically recognizing that the oil sands would be difficult to figure out how to unlock and that we'd be better off companies coming together with government also provided some funding to solve this problem collectively,
right?
Because it couldn't really be done alone.
Well, you know, what a concept. Let's collaborate, right? And I think that that's what I'm hoping for when it comes to this issue of climate change, which we also discussed in our last podcast. It's so important because the energy industry at large right now is so polarized. It's so polarized and into different camps that if we are going to address issues of sustainability, issues of emissions, issues of water usage, whatever, right? We got big issues as you think about the level of overall energy consumption. That collaboration has to be the way it's going to go, not only within, say, the oil and gas industry, but I'm hoping for collaboration across all the energy systems.
Right, yeah, because basically we have big problems to solve. If we all solve them in our own silos, it's going to take longer and cost more. So this gets us accelerated. And we another example in Canada is this COSIA, Canadian Oil Sands Producers, coming together with the same idea. Like, why should we all develop technologies to reduce carbon emissions? Collectively, we can do it a lot faster.
Yeah.
And so this is great news. And I think very important because I believe that oil and gas producers have to be part of the solution. You know, there are some folks out there that say, you know, we should just shut the oil companies down. We should divest of them, and they should go away, and we should have these new companies come up that are going to be clean energy companies. But when you think about how big these companies are, the expertise that exists inside of them, and the fact that they can, you know, the balance sheets to fund projects, the expertise to build major projects, the chances of us solving the climate change issue with them transitioning is, to me, much higher than expecting these companies that are supported today by venture capitalists to solve these pressing problems.
I think that's a key point. I mean, this is not like Remington typewriters yielding to the word processor, okay? Like, this transition away from fossil fuels is going to take decades, and evidenced by just the gargantuan numbers, including that 100 to 101 million barrels a day of oil consumption. So to think that this is going to happen quickly, much like Netflix versus Blockbuster Video, is completely naive. We need collaborative solutions, and it's really heartening. And I think we have to clean up the existing systems. And this is a great example of how it potentially is starting already.
Okay, so let's talk about specifically the investment funds, that they are the billion-dollar funds. And there was some very good information on a podcast last week from the Columbia Energy Exchange, hosted by Jason Bordoff. And he interviewed the head of the fund, Dr. Pratima Rungrajan, who gave some great insights on their investment strategy. Huh. And so she talked about the areas of focus. One of the big areas is methane measurement and reductions. Now, this is important. Methane has really come into the spotlight, not only because it has more potency than CO2 in the atmosphere, but also because it has a much shorter lifespan. By reducing methane, we can actually influence the warming in the planet much more quickly than addressing CO2. So it's really low-hanging fruit in terms of solving the problem of climate change.
Well, and it's a here and now, right? This is what we got to do. This is a here and now that can be done.
Yes, and this group has said that they are going to take a voluntary target to achieve 0.25% of methane leaking, not just within their own operations, but kind of looking across the value
chain. That's a target, not a reduction, 0.25.
That's where they want to get to.
Right.
And it's an important number because there was a paper study published this past summer in Science that had a lot of great data that went into it. There was 10 universities across the U.S., major agencies like NOAA, Environmental Defense Fund was involved, that estimated that in the U.S., the methane leaking was 2.3% of all U.S. gas production. So I'll talk a bit about that paper. But what they're saying is we want to get that down to 0.25%.
Right. But I mean, we've been in North America using natural gas in one form or another for almost 100 years, right? So this is a lot of legacy systems, the old leaky pipes and so on, isn't that?
That's right. And, you know, there's some people that still kind of debate this number, but based on this paper, that was the number. And of course, they can't measure everything. Mm-hmm. But what they tried to do is measure a number of areas. And what they found is there's these super emitters. There's some places where there's a big leak and there's a lot of methane coming. And that's what's causing the numbers to be so high. Now, with these type of numbers, it starts to make you question if there's a real advantage of using natural gas over coal, if that's the number.
Yeah.
But what I'd say is, well, you know, coal, most of the emissions from coal are in combustion, and you can't do anything about that. Mm-hmm. But this leaking methane problem can be solved. I think it can get to 0.25% leaking and maybe even lower. And it's great to see these companies signing up because natural gas is the fuel of the future and can be quite clean because many of these issues around leaking are easily solved. You just have to know where the leaks are. And so interestingly enough, they are investing in companies that are basically doing much more work to detect these leaks as they happen so you can solve them right away.
So it's not only fixing the leaks, it's the technology to detect the leaks as well.
Exactly.
And there's some companies that are popping up to doing that kind of thing as well, right?
Yeah, and they're actually funding some of them. We can talk about some of the technologies, but you know, first thing is to know you have a leak. Solving it actually isn't that as big of a problem as knowing it's there.
They can actually detect this stuff from satellites now.
That's right. In fact, one of the companies they're investing in is going to have funding to be able to just sort of look for large emitters by satellite. There's also a company that's going to fly over sites to detect methane emissions. So, you know, we can very efficiently cover large areas and detect where these super emitters are. And that's one of the areas that they're spending money in terms of the new investment fund.
So lots of new technologies and things in the whole clean tech space. I know we're going to be talking a lot more about that space as well.
Yes. Yeah. Well, in future podcasts, we want to spend much more time about there's so many technologies, not only in methane, but in carbon reduction.
Yeah.
So another pillar of their investment strategy is carbon capture storage. And now it's being called CCS, right? Because there's a new CCU.
Okay, so can they're just adding, adding letters to the whole thing, right? CCSU.
Yeah, because basically saying, you know, the economics of storage don't work because there's no economic case for doing that. But if we could find a way to use carbon, then there would be an economic case. And so they talked about a company.
Like, use it to make products.
Right. Like use it for cements because you could use some CO2 in cement. And also talked about a technology that they're investing in, which is actually going to take the CO2 and turn it into a building block for petrochemicals.
So this is instead of blowing it into the atmosphere, actually taking the stream of CO2 and making something out of it.
Exactly. And there's a lot of initiatives in this vein. It's not, you know, they're not unique, but I think this is an emerging area where there's a lot of investment going, but I still believe that storage is important, and they do too. They believe that, you know, in order to meet these ambitious climate goals, we are going to have to start storing carbon because it's hard to sort of see us getting off fossil fuels as quickly as some of these forecasts like that study last week is.
Yeah, I think it's important to explore. It's a tough one. I got to be honest with you. I mean, storing the CO2 stream, which basically means piping it and compressing it and pushing it down a hole a couple kilometers into a reservoir, right? So it's sort of a parasitic energy system. In other words, it uses a lot of energy to get rid of the waste, right? So it's just like, okay, well, where are we going to get the energy to compress the CO2 to put it down a hole, put up another solar farm?
You need more power plants.
Yeah. So, I mean, the whole notion of burying waste, I would much rather see, you know, more productive uses for the CO2, or as we said, because it's so much on the consuming end is part of the problem. We've talked about that in our last podcast, is that thinking of just better ways of encouraging energy efficiency, conservation, and so on can go a long way to mitigating the problem.
Yeah, I mean, I see what you're saying. And I do think that I remember when I first heard about carbon capture and storage, it was like, wow, that's going to be a lot of, when you start to do the numbers, it's going to be a lot of carbon that we would have to store. But when you look at the aggressive targets needed, and we talked about that last week, you know, to this 1.5 degree scenario saying we need to get net zero by 2050, I don't think it's possible if we don't start storing carbon.
No, I hear you. And I'm hoping before then there's going to be technologies that figure, that we haven't even thought of, that figure all this out, that doesn't require us to bury the stuff underground. Because candidly, it's not only a technological problem, an energy cost problem, but there's also legal issues. Like you bury it underground. Well, okay, who owns it now? And what if it leaks? The ownership is such that they could get sued if it's proved to be leakage. So who wants to own it?
Yeah, what are they going to charge? Liabilities.
The liabilities. Yeah. Like who's gonna take on the liabilities even once it's underground? There's all sorts of complexities that actually transcend technology.
And you haven't even gotten into the important part, is there's no economic model for it. So, you know, today there's no value to capturing CO2 and injecting it in most countries unless you have a tax on carbon. But even then, it's not, nowhere in the world is it high enough to really support carbon capture just for itself. Now, we definitely have carbon capture in specific cases, for example, in using it for enhanced oil recovery, where there's an economic driver for it.
Yeah,
we need the policy if it's going to happen. It's not going to happen without it. And then, like you say, you need to deal with all these liability issues. So, you know, I still believe it has to be part of the solution. I get lots has to change, and we'll wait and see. But to get to that net zero quickly, I think we're going to need it for some period of time.
Right. In the meantime, we've got all sorts of interesting, exciting technologies. We've got some collaboration going on. So it's moving in the right direction.
Good. Well, we've covered a lot of topics this week, everything from the oil markets on the potential for recession and geopolitics, the new role that oil and gas companies are playing in addressing climate change, and of course, the technology.
Great.
So thanks everyone for listening, and goodbye till next time.
For more ideas and insights, visit arcenergyinstitute.com.